and welcome to another episode of Upzoned, where every week we take just one big story that touches the Strong Towns conversation in some way, and we upzone it. I'm Kia, and I am here back with Chuck this week. How are you doing, Chuck?
Hey, I'm doing great. Back home, a little bit more rested, and anxious about 16 inches plus of snow we're supposed to get here the next day.
Oh my gosh. I know you just got back from a little global tour across the state of New Hampshire. You got to know New Hampshire very well.
And I did.
Yeah, all over the place. We were together in California before that. I think you were in a different state in between.
In DC in between doing a TED talk, and that should be out here soon. But so it's been a couple of weeks of crazy travel.
Right. Well, I have been happily situated in St. Louis, enjoying the 70-degree sunshine before we get the tail end of your snowstorm. I'm choosing to blame it on Minnesota this time around. Usually I blame it on Canada, but not today. I have an article that I'm actually pretty excited to talk to you about this week, Chuck, because it, I think, touches on what I must admit is one of the most nebulous aspects of the Strong Towns mission, for me at least, which is also one of the most important aspects of the Strong Towns mission. It's the idea that our city should be planned around bottom-up feedback. And of course, the questions that go into that are, what is that feedback and how do we collect it? There's a new article from Curbed that is about, you know, buzzword alert, smart city technology in kind of all of its forms, whether that is apps that make community engagement something that folks can participate on the go. When you see a pothole on the street, you take a picture of it and you send it to a developer, an app developer who will communicate it to your local officials, or whether that's, you know, making smart traffic control devices. Like, for instance, they give the example of a street light that senses when cyclists are coming through an intersection and increases the length of the light because it's a slower moving vehicle. That's kind of cool. But as I'm thinking about all this, I'm also thinking about a lot of conversations you and I have had, Chuck, about what do these sort of techie smart city solutions miss? Are they a way to scale up our bottom-up feedback that is so important to building strong towns? Or are they something that's distracting from the more soulful solutions we could get if we just got some clipboards, went to a bus stop, and started talking to people? I'm curious, kind of just to talk philosophically with you about this one. What do you think?
When I go back to 20, 25 years ago, for me, I'm 45. I go back to when I was in college. I was building computers. The thing that impressed my father-in-law ultimately was not that I was in the army or I was going to be an engineer or any like the responsible things that I had done with my life at that point, but that I actually built my wife a computer. He's like, oh, wow, this guy knows something. I say this because I have been my whole life like an early adopter of technology, a big fan of what technology could do. As a guy in my mid-40s now, I'm finding myself becoming more and more curmudgeonly about it all. And not that I think that the technology is bad. I mean, I think it's fascinating. And, we live in this age of marvels and miracles where we're just constantly in awe of what can happen and what people can do to make our lives better. I still step back and just say, gosh, way too often technology that we're obsessed with, not the actual problem. In other words, we have the technology and we're like, how do we apply this? As opposed to, we have this urgent problem or this thing we're trying to deal with. How do we deploy technology to help us with this? And that might be a fine nuance, but I don't think it is when it comes to our places.
Well, I'm anxious to hear more about that as we go through and talk, but I want to kind of just step back and focus in on one element of the Curbed article because it's huge and it's a really interesting one in a lot of ways, which is the community engagement piece of tech. You wrote an article for Strong Towns called Most Public Engagement is Worthless. And then one of our members chimed in with an article that said Most Public Engagement is Worse Than Worthless, which definitely got us some shares on social media because it's a little bit of a controversial stance. I think some people look to the appification of the community engagement process as a more democratic way to do it. So I gave the example of, you know, there are apps out there where you can that replace the citizen service bureaus, essentially. You can report a pothole in real time when your neighbor reports the same pothole that like bumps it up the Reddit queue of citizen complaints. You can upvote things. You can basically organize in a digital space around the problems that you really want to see solved. And it might really save your city some time then and get some real eyes on the ground. What makes you feel skeptical about that, though? Because I know that you and I have had some conversations privately about how that there are some drawbacks to that approach.
I like the novelty of some of those, but I don't think it really replaces what needs to happen. I have in my mind, and this is like old school. If you look at the Hoover Dam, built in the Great Depression, inside the Hoover Dam, there are these sensors that are embedded in the concrete. They're dumb sensors. They're smart technology from the time, but it's not like you can go in now and dig them out and replace them. I mean, they're 1930s technology sensors in the middle of the Hoover Dam. There's people who walk around every day and like read these sensors, and what they're reading for is stress in this big structure. And the readings are graphed out over time. So you get these long data sets about what's the trends and internal stress. I find that kind of application technology to be brilliant. In other words, it's not flashy in any way, but what it is you're asking an important question, and then you're deploying your technology to answer that question for you and track it over time. So as a city, if we are saying the big question, where are people struggling? Or if we get like to a micro question on a block level, how many people walk or bike through here? There's all kinds of sensors we can deploy to try to give us data that will provide insights into that question. When we go out and we say, what do you want? Pick A or B in your survey on your smartphone. You're going to get a certain response that is both like A, curated, and B, kind of exclusive to the group that you're asking, that I don't think is really representative of the problems we're struggling with. I look out my window here at the office, and there's a steady stream of people walking past from the poorest neighborhood in town to the grocery store on the other side of town. They walk through here all day, whether it's raining or snowing. There's a path worn in the ditch because they walk so much. There is no C-Click Fix, which is a great program, by the way, but there's no model of this that's going to say, hey, my life sucks here because you built this despotic thing. There's no like app for that. There's no button for that, right?
Yeah.
But if we actually had like a sensor, which would be easy to install and easy to do, that said, okay, who's using this stretch? Where are they coming from? What are, you know, how often do they pass by? That's a fancy way of also saying, you just get off your butt and go out and look. I mean, it's not like a path through the ditch is a hard thing to discover. I mean, it's right there. We're trying to use this technology to accomplish something that we could easily accomplish if we ask the right questions. And if we don't ask the right questions, we're going to be using technology to solve the wrong problems. And I guess that's where I struggle and get a little bit curmudgeonly about it.
What you're describing with the path through the ditch, for folks who are new to our conversations, the term that gets often is desire lines. You know, when there's a corner that someone doesn't want to walk all the way to one end of the intersection and then all the way on a right angle back. They just want to cut diagonally to get to the shortest point from A to B. And they leave a path if enough people walk that same little corner over time. And you mentioned desire lines as another way of like quantifying bottom-up feedback. So it seems like we're talking about kind of two different things. There's the feedback of, you know, where can we observe things like desire lines? Where can we put sensors to map how many people are moving through a space on a given form of transportation? And then there's also the questions that people are asking. Let's talk about the second one a little bit more. How can like local decision makers, either if you're trying to make the best app in the world, because maybe there is an app that can ask the right questions, or if you're trying to just one-on-one walk up to a bus stop and ask someone where they struggle, how can you make those questions more meaningful so you get information that you can act upon? Because you're right, Chuck, that if you ask people what they want, it's sort of that thing you quote from Steve Jobs all the time. Like if Steve Jobs had asked people what they wanted, they would have said they wanted a better Walkman. They wouldn't have described the iPod, right? So like, how do we create questions that are meaningful as bottom-up feedback as data is? And how do we then deploy it using technology or not?
This is why I kind of fell back on that Hoover Dam example. Because you're not asking, like, the dam, how do you feel today? You're not saying, like, what's your mood like? Or what would you desire, you know, big hunk of concrete? You're actually, like, measuring stress in it. One of the things that we make the mistake of doing is assuming that humans are rational and that they know and understand intuitively what they want. This is the Steve Jobs insight. And that sounds kind of elitist to say it that way, but it's actually the opposite. Here's where technology and the technology mindset, I think, does the best job for us, or what we can learn the most from technology. If you build an app, or if you build a piece of software or a web page, the most advanced designers do something really powerful and intuitive. They watch how people use their app. They actually look and monitor. And instead of having surveys and say, what features would you like? Or what things would you think would be really great? What they do is they monitor how people use their app. Where do they get stuck? Where do they have a hard time? Where do they get through fluidly? When we add another little feature, do people use it or not? You're not measuring people's, like, stated preferences. You're not doing you might do that a little bit to get kind of a guidance of maybe where to start. But what you're doing is you're iterating off of what people actually do. If I went out to the bus stop with a clipboard, I might talk to people and say, you know, hey, you know, what do you think? How you doing? But the questions that I would ask would be, where'd you come from? Where are you going? Can I walk with you on your way home and experience that? Will you tell me what is going on? I would observe where people went and where they struggled with things. That is a level of information that technology could really help with. But it's technology more like a sensor in a dam, as opposed to technology like an app that's going to, like, have Zen feelings wash over you. You know, it's a very different application of technology. And I think if we do it that way, the tech can really, really help us. But, you know, that article you sent me had a lot of these, how do we make things that we're uncomfortable with right now, like public engagement, how do we make that more, you know, happy so that we feel better about it? And I think that things that make us feel better are kind of shallow and fake, really, especially in this realm of working.
Totally. I mean, I want to give one egregious example that was not in the Curbed article, but I saw, I think it was a Fast Company article about it the other day, which was, for some reason, I was just getting deluged with, like, op-eds about various apps that people could log into to self-report things that are wrong with their city. And there was specifically one called Smell My City, which is where you can download an app on your phone, you can walk around your town sniffing stuff, and you can report when you smell something that feels wrong. And I don't know where that data goes, but apparently it started in good iterative fashion in Pittsburgh with Smell Pittsburgh, and now it's going worldwide. And I paused for a second because I was like, who would download that? You know, like, it felt more like a good way for cities to say, like, look, we are logged into the Smell My City empire. We're paying attention to environmental disturbances in our places. People have this opportunity to self-report, and then we can do whatever we want with that information. But, like, what an entirely tiny self-selecting group of people that would be. And, I mean, that's an egregious example, but even when I think about, like, who uses the Citizen Service Bureau here in St. Louis, you know, like the portal you log into to report if a traffic light is out or road signalization for the pedestrian crosswalk sign is too short, all these little things, the kind of person who sits down and uses that stuff, me, for instance, is a very particular kind of person. And the language that I'm going to use to describe it is going to be very particular kind of language. And even more so if I'm someone who doesn't happen to work with a bunch of urban planning and engineering nerds and have a little bit of vocabulary, at least a little bit more than the average person. It's just this question of, like, passive community engagement is really interesting to me because, on the one hand, I like the idea of platforms that anyone can log into and just speak up. On the other hand, how meaningful are they if you're relying on the user profile of a Smell My City app downloader to be the basis of your data?
I think that apps that help us communicate with each other are really, I have a lot of positive applications at the block and neighborhood level. I don't think they're a way to, like, you live in St. Louis. I don't think it's a way to aggregate public opinion over the city of St. Louis. I just don't. I don't necessarily think elections are a great way to aggregate public opinion.
Oh, God. But it's so hard to talk about because I believe so profoundly in democracy in a lot of ways.
I do too. You know? I do too. And I think that elections represent snapshots of the opinions of irrational people on a specific date and time and how they interpret a person or an individual in relation to where they're at. But I don't think it's like a referendum for the most part on like a whole set of policy outcomes. We're doing a comp plan here in my city, and it has been more than a frustrating endeavor for me because for the large part, well-intentioned city staff and, you know, consultant planners have done community surveys that asked really badly worded questions. They then got responses that were all over the map and interpreted them in a way that was comfortable to them to then give us recommendations on what policy should be. And not only are they doing that, but they're also claiming somehow like a mandate for this from the people. I find the whole exercise kind of not only maddening, but just kind of farcical, right? Like it's ridiculous. Let me give you an example of data. Right now, engineers will go out and they will do traffic counts. Everyone's seen this where they'll put like a little thing that you drive over and it counts the number of cars. I used to do this back when I was an undergrad. I would go out and you'd put the little counter in the ditch and then you'd run the hose across. And every time it would drive over, it would do a little air shock thing and bump the counter up by one. And you'd leave it out there for a week and then come back. And the engineers have all these charts and data to, you know, if you're out there the third week of July, here's how you standardize it for the second week of June. You know how cheap it would be right now to just put on like every stop sign a little sensor that would tell you how many cars went by?
Really?
Like in real time.
It would be cheap? I'm surprised by that.
It would be dirt cheap. Cool. No, it'd be really, really cheap. You could have real-time traffic data for your entire city in relatively like low cost, particularly compared to the ongoing like infrastructure of traffic counting that we do that is literally a joke. We could do this for pedestrians. We could do this for bikes. And we could monitor policy changes in real time as they take place, kind of the ebbs and flows of these systems that we've, these, you know, adaptive systems that we have. Why don't we go do that? You know, if we're so obsessed with technology, like why don't we set up sensors that would do something like that? Here in my town, we struggle with getting people to the downtown. And there's this question of, are people going? Where do they park? Do we have enough parking? Do we not have enough parking? There's no data on any of this. With the right technology, the right little set of sensors deployed, it would be really, really easy to answer this question. Really easy to answer this question. But we're more interested in, you know, how do we take the planning process that planners have made so laborious and meaningless and somehow put that on an app. And I recoil at it. You know, it's asking the wrong questions.
I mean, I think part of the reason it's asking the wrong questions is for good-hearted reasons. It's because we're dealing with the fact that cities are ecosystems that have like physical laws. And a lot of what it sounds like you're calling for, Chuck, is the kind of things that like biologists do when they're like watching prides of lions like walk across the plains and you're observing where they're struggling to find wildebeests and that kind of a thing. But people aren't animals. People have insights to give. They do. They're important. You know, we're both writers here. We believe that, you know, we want to understand in verbal terms, in real words, how things go. And we also want our systems to be democratic, not just feedback responsive, which I think there's an important difference there. So what are some...
Can I add this though to
please.
I think that human input, we are a more advanced form of biological machine. We have intuitiveness. We can overcome our own wiring. You know, we can make choices that go against our own wiring. We have this capacity. So I don't think like humans have no insight, but I think humans can be helpful in creating narratives, you know, creating like theories of understanding, but you got to have like data. Joe Menicozzi's work is really great at this. He goes and shows you like, here's the most productive parcels in your city. If you ask people beforehand, where's the most productive parcels? They'll give you a narrative. They'll tell you a story. And then you show them the data and it's exactly the opposite from their story. So do we listen to people or do we listen to data? And I think at the end of the day, what we say is, okay, what are your values? Do you want places that are more productive? Those are the types of questions that are really good. You know, like what are your goals? What are your aims? And then the data is like a way to say, okay, here's how your aims match up with reality. How do we reconcile this? Oftentimes, instead of saying like, what are your goals? We'll say like, what do you want? Well, I want, you know, a bike lane here, or I want, you know, this. You're not really helping anybody when you do that. I don't think you're getting very far.
Yeah. A better question is, I want to arrive at X destination in one piece. How do we do that?
I think traffic is a good way to think about this too, because people will say, we need another lane. When what they're actually saying is, I want to reduce my travel time. Well, okay. Those are two very different things. The first one will cost you a ton of money and won't really affect your travel time. The second one is a tangible thing that we could work on in different ways.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. Well, be sure to write in if you want to defend some of the smart city solutions that we've been a little skeptical of here. I would love to keep talking to you because I think this is a lively conversation that will only get more lively as this technology continues to develop. And I want to keep talking about it on Strong Towns. You can always write us an email just at team@strongtowns.org. It'll get to us. But now, Chuck, I want to talk about what you have been listening to, watching, reading. It's Downzone time. Tell me what's on your media hit list right now.
Very good question. I finished my Lord of the Rings trilogy, my Lenten reading, which was really fun. I actually have one more book I need to read before next week, but I got back to my audiobook list. I finished one by Tim Carney called Alienated America, Why Some Places Thrive While Others Collapse. And it was an interesting kind of mashup of desperation politics with desperation places. And kind of got a little bit into the Trump primary victories and why he did well in some places and not well in others, and tied that directly to the level of community and community kind of connectedness, which is a really powerful way to look at it. I'm now going through Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth.
Yeah, I read that. We talked about that on episode one.
By Sarah Smarsh. I know.
I have the same editor as her, apparently. I just learned that the other day. Isn't that funny?
Well, I've got an in to have her on the podcast, and I really want to do that. And I wanted to get through this book. It's been recommended to me by many, many people. And I'm three chapters in, and it's a insightful, enjoyable. She's got a beautiful writing style, so.
Oh, that's great. God, I feel like I have nothing to contribute that Strong Towns fans would like jump at the chance to read, because I went to visit my family over the weekend and I've just been doing vacation reading, which for me is like moody Irish mysteries. I read The Witch Elm by Tana French, which I thought was like, I'm a nerd for just writing fiction in general. And like as a crafted narrative, it is so weird and so good and so strange for most people who are not like many, many years deep into a literary education. They would just think it's like a really gripping, interesting mystery story about a guy who in the first part of the book gets beat up and, you know, is within an inch of his life in his apartment. And then 50 pages later, he goes to recover at an uncle's estate and they find a skeleton inside of the witch elm, inside of the trunk of a tree. I loved it. I thought it was so good. And it's super long. It's super strange in the way it controls its pacing. And I thought it was great. So yeah, I'm going to give everyone permission to go read something like a silly mystery if you want to and overanalyze it.
I want to ask you a movie question because you and I are both movie people.
Yep.
Pet Sematary, yes or no?
I haven't seen it yet. I will see it.
Oh, for crying out loud.
I know.
Like the previews gave me nightmares. Like there's no way I would ever go to that movie.
Oh, I see like any horror movie that is released commercially in theaters. Like I don't have to know anything about it. I will go see it, you know, and it's a remake. I've seen the first one. Though fun fact, I've never read a Stephen King novel. I'm kind of holding on to that now. Everyone makes fun of me. I lost a trivia question at Bar Trivia the other night because I couldn't remember that he was the author of Needful Things. But I've seen like all of the horror movies that are based on his novels. So I got the gist. Yeah, I will go see it. I think it's going to be fun. So.
Well, I have to run because I am now on sudden notice. I'm supposed to be speaking in Aspen tomorrow. Aspen, Colorado, and we're getting 16 inches of snow. And I guess they're getting like bombed in Denver right now. They canceled my flight to Denver. So to make it to this thing, I have to leave Brainerd in like 15 minutes. So I got to go home and pack my bags and go. I'm driving to Minneapolis. I'm taking a late flight to Bozeman, Montana. I'm going to sleep in the Bozeman, Montana airport for 8 hours or like an 8 hour layover. Then I'm going to fly to Salt Lake City. I'm going to drive 7 hours to Aspen. Because you know what? We don't cancel.
I know, we do not. The Strong Towns message will reach Aspen.
Exactly. When we say we'll be there, we will be there. When you build an event around us being there, we will be there. So
that's too funny. Well, I'm going to let you drop the mic and sprint to Colorado now,
Thank
Chuck.
You.
Thanks so much, everyone, for listening to Upzoned. I will skip all my usual outro so Chuck can get off the call and just say thanks for listening and keep doing what you can to build a strong town.